Do you know anything about that? Her eyes got wide with surprise, and I knew I was right. We were talking about the same night. Where did he go?
The woods,
she said after a long pause.
He went into the woods behind his house.
Did you go with him?
No! No, I didn't do anything, I swear I didn't do anything!
It's okay, you're not in any trouble. What was Jeremiah doing? Why did he sneak out? Her eyes went to the window, and then the open closet door, as if to reassure herself there were no monsters to be found.
To hunt for the Ursulina,
she told me, as if it were the most natural thing in the world.
Remember last Halloween? You sang about it, and the man with no leg told that story.
I closed my eyes and felt terrible, because I couldn't help thinking that this was partly my fault. Yes, I remember.
Jeremiah said if we found the Ursulina, we'd be famous. But I told him it was too dangerous. He said he didn't care. He was going to find it all by himself.
And that's what he did?
Yes.
And he didn't tell anyone about it?
Just me.
Okay. Anna, what happened that night? Why was Jeremiah so scared when he got home? Anna grabbed a pillow and clutched it to her chest like a stuffed animal.
He was out there, and he saw.
I spoke softly. What did he see, Anna?
He saw it. He saw the Ursulina.
A little sigh came out with my breath. Anna, whatever Jeremiah saw, it wasn't the Ursulina. Believe me, the Ursulina is a myth. It's not real. The stories we told on Halloween, those were just funny things we made up.
No, Shelby. Jeremiah saw the Ursulina.
How do you know? Anna didn't answer. Now she was crying. Anna, it's okay. Tell me, why are you so sure Jeremiah saw the Ursulina? The girl reached out and grabbed my hand. She whispered to me,
because he saw it kill somebody.
Chapter 23. I went downstairs and found Ellen and Dennis Sloan, who were still with Agent Reed. Jeremiah's parents were shooting silent, hostile stares across the room at each other, as if they were prize fighters on opposite sides of the ring. Since Friday, the stress of losing their son had already begun to split them apart. I knew I was about to make it worse. I'm sorry to interrupt, but Anna Helvick told me something about Jeremiah that may be important. Ellen studied me with cool surprise. Anna did? Yes. Anna and Jeremiah haven't talked in months. I know. Ellen looked at Agent Reed as if inquiring whether he was going to allow me to get in the middle of this. As far as Ellen was concerned, I was just a young deputy who'd gotten a job because my father was the sheriff. But Agent Reed gave me the slightest nod, which was the signal to continue. Did the two of you know that Jeremiah sneaked out of his bedroom one night last fall? I asked. Ellen shook her head to dismiss the idea immediately. Jeremiah? That's ridiculous. He wouldn't do that. But Dennis's reaction on the other side of the room was different. He swallowed hard and looked away from his wife. Ellen noticed the uncomfortable expression on his face. Dennis? She said sharply.
I did know that, he admitted.
You did? Why didn't you tell me about it?
I talked to Jer. He said he wouldn't do it again. I figured we didn't need to make a big thing of it.
Well, why did he sneak out? What was he doing?
It was stupid. It's the kind of thing boys do. He told me he was hunting for the Ursulina. He and Anna were obsessed with it back then, remember?
You should have told me, Ellen snapped. I can't believe you kept this from me.
I didn't want to worry you.
But I knew that wasn't the real reason, and the real reason had to come out, regardless of the consequences for Dennis and Ellen. Mr. Sloan, how did you find out about this? I asked. Dennis's flushed face got redder. I could see him thinking. Does she know?
I caught Jer climbing back inside, he replied. He quickly added with exasperation in his voice, I don't understand why you're asking about this. It was last year. As far as I know, Jeremiah didn't do it again. Believe me, I checked his room every night to be sure. How is any of this going to help you find my son?
I realized that Agent Reed was right. People lie. They lie about everything. They lie to protect themselves. They lie even when their child's life hangs in the balance. Mr. Sloan, I talked to Jeannie Samper. She told me what happened. Ellen looked at me with angry frustration, but I think she already suspected that I was opening a door that would be better left closed.
Jeannie Samper? From the Raptor Center? What does she have to do with any of this? Agent Reed, I think we've had just about enough of this nonsense.
But Reed could see the stricken look in Dennis Sloan's eyes.
Mr. Sloan, I think it would be better for all of us if you simply answered Deputy Lake's questions.
Dennis's face was a mixture of shame and rage.
Fine. What do you want to know?
Did you ask Jeannie Samper if her son Matthew could babysit for you that night?
Yes.
His voice was like the crack of a bullet.
Matthew Samper? Ellen interrupted. When was this? Where was I?
I held up my hands. Mrs. Sloan, let's just try to get through this, okay? Mr. Sloan, you asked Matthew if he could stay here all night, isn't that right? Dennis spat the word at me again.
Yes.
So you weren't actually home when Jeremiah sneaked out?
No.
The realization dawned on Ellen's face, which turned gray as charcoal and just as hot. It's one thing to hear rumors about infidelity. It's another to have the truth thrown at you while your child is missing. I could see the wheels turning in her mind, and then she finally spoke.
New Orleans, right?
She asked calmly with a cold glance at her husband.
I took Adrian with me on that trip. Is that when it was?
Dennis hung his head.
Yes.
Who was it? Breezy? It's always her. You're always running back to her. How long has it been going on, Dennis?
How many years? Ellen, do we have to do this now?
Dennis pleaded.
What does it matter who it was? Yes, I was out all night. Yes, I wasn't alone. It has nothing to do with Jeremiah.
Mr. Sloan, I'm sorry, I interrupted, but we really do need to verify your whereabouts that night.
Why on earth does that matter?
I didn't tell him anything more. I waited without explaining. I could see Agent Reed getting impatient with Dennis, too.
Mr. Sloan, tell us where you were,
he barked.
Answer the question. Fine, whatever. I don't know what difference any of this makes. Yes, I was with Belinda Breeze.
In which tree? I asked.
No, we went to a hotel in Martin's Point. We spent the night.
Ellen shot to her feet. I knew she wanted to storm away, but she didn't. She needed to hear the rest. She needed to know why this was coming up now. When did you get home? I asked Dennis.
About 10 the next morning. It was Sunday.
What did Matthew Samper tell you?
He said he checked Jeremiah's room about 1 in the morning and Jeremiah was gone. He searched the house and found him on our back porch. My son told him he was just out looking at the stars, but Matthew said he didn't think that was true. So I talked to Jeremiah about it. Eventually, he admitted he'd gone out on this crazy expedition to find the Ursulina. I told him he could have gotten hurt and that he was never to do anything like that again. He swore to me he was done. As far as I know, that was that.
Was Jeremiah frightened when you talked to him? I said.
Of course he was, scared to death.
Did he say why?
He's a little boy. He felt guilty that I'd found him out.
Is that all?
Yes, that's all.
When was this?
Last fall? November?
What date?
I don't remember.
Mrs. Sloan, I asked quietly, do you remember? I could tell that Ellen had already guessed the truth because she put her hand over her lips with a kind of frozen horror.
My conference was the weekend of the 14th.
Then she went on, as if we could read each other's minds.
Is that possible, Shelby?
Do you really think?
Yes, I do, I replied. It was November 14th. That was the night Colleen Whalen was shot and killed. I think Jeremiah was there. I think he saw it happen.
Chapter 24. I finally did what I should have done months ago. I confessed. We were all gathered in the dark, dank sheriff's office. Me, Dad, Monica, Adam, Violet, Agent Reed. Before we could start talking about what to do next, I told them that I had something to say. And that was when I laid it all out. I told them exactly what had happened on Halloween night during Ursulina days. How Keith and I went back to his place together. How we talked. How we drank. How we had sex in the old barn with his wife asleep in the main house a quarter mile away. The face I didn't want to see as I confessed was my father's, but I had to look at him anyway. He had this sad, sad expression that was like a knife in my heart. I knew he was disappointed in me for what I'd done. The affair with a married man, and worse, concealing it when I knew things that might have changed the direction of a murder investigation. Keith Whalen's marriage hadn't been fine, no matter what he'd told us back then. He'd cheated with me only 2 weeks before her death. If Colleen knew, if she'd found out, if he'd told her, then he had a motive to kill her. The next step in the investigation was to question Keith. Not just about Colleen, but about Jeremiah, too. If I was right that Jeremiah had seen Colleen Whalen being killed, if that was what had terrified him the night of November 14th, then Jeremiah was a witness to murder, and witnesses were always at risk. The question was what the boy had actually seen. Anna didn't know. Jeremiah hadn't told her who the Ursulina was, but Keith was the obvious suspect. I wasn't going to play a role in the interrogation. I knew that. My father was the natural person to question Keith, but Violet suggested in her usual pointed way that Dad's relationship with me had poisoned his involvement in the case. He didn't argue with her. I assumed Agent Reed would take over, but Reed thought a local cop should take the lead. So that meant Adam would question Keith. Adam jumped at the chance. He was hungry for an opportunity to prove himself after his drunken voicemail the previous night. Strangely, when I looked at him, I realized that he didn't look like a kid anymore. He wasn't James Dean on his motorcycle. The last couple of days had sobered and matured him. I felt the same way about myself. Maybe that's what happens when you have to confront your mistakes. We drove to Keith's land, which was located down a dead-end road from the main highway. As the crow flies, we weren't even a mile from where the Sloanes lived. It was an easy hike through the forest for a 10-year-old boy. Keith wasn't in the main house, but his car was outside the garage, so I guessed where he was. I led the parade over a shallow hill to Keith's renovated barn. It was mid-afternoon under bright sun, a beautiful day, and humid enough to make me sweat and make my uniform stick to my skin. I stayed outside alone and listened to the raucous blackbirds while Adam and Agent Reed went inside. I didn't think they would be there long. Once Keith realized that he was a suspect, I assumed he would ask for a lawyer and shut up. That was the smart thing to do. But Keith was impulsive and had other ideas. I had only been waiting there for a couple of minutes when Reed returned and waved me toward the barn. I thought we agreed I shouldn't be part of this, I said.
We did. But Whalen doesn't want a lawyer. He wants you. He says he'll talk to us, but only if you're there.
I didn't want to do it, but I went inside. The barn assaulted me with memories, mostly bad ones. I remembered the jazz music playing, although it was silent now, and every footstep echoed from the wood floor to the high ceiling. I could hear my guitar and feel the strings under my fingertips as I sang the Ursulina song. I could smell the mustiness of the barn and the peat of the whiskey we drank. I remembered the crackle and ash of the roaring fireplace and the smoke that burned my eyes.
There, in front of the fire, was the white sheepskin rug where I'd made my foolish mistake. Keith sat in a leather recliner watching me. His eyes said that he knew what I was remembering, and he was remembering the same things. The rest of us took up chairs around him, and Adam sat in the middle like judge and jury. Adam removed his deputy's hat with both hands and carefully placed it next to his chair. He smoothed the sleeves of his uniform and kept his black boots flat on the floor.
"Okay, Shelby's here. Are you willing to talk to us?"
"Why not?"
Keith replied.
"I don't have anything to hide. I didn't kill my wife. I didn't have anything to do with Jeremiah's disappearance. I'll save you the trouble and repeat what I told you 8 months ago. I was at the lake all day. I came home late. It was nearly midnight. I found Colleen dead outside our house. She'd been shot. I called the police. That's all I know."
"Except you told us back then that there were no problems between you and Colleen. And now Shelby tells us that you and she slept together only 2 weeks before your wife was killed. That's a pretty important detail to omit."
Keith didn't look surprised that I'd exposed our relationship. I wanted to sink down through the floor of the barn as I watched his face. I'd done the right thing, but I'd also betrayed him.
"Yes, Shelby and I slept together. That was a mistake, my mistake. It was a huge error of judgment on my part, and I take full responsibility for it. It happened one time and never again, but I shouldn't have concealed it from you."
"Was that the only time during your marriage that you were unfaithful?"
"Yes, it was."
"Did you feel guilty about it?"
"Of course I did."
"Did you tell Colleen what you did?"
I watched Keith hesitate.
"No."
"You kept the affair from your wife?"
"Yes."
"Did she suspect?"
"Not that I know of."
"Do you think other people in town suspected something between you and Shelby?"
"I don't know. I don't see how they could."
"Was there chemistry between the two of you? Were you attracted to her?"
Keith's mouth was tight.
"Yes, obviously."
"Was your wife there for the Halloween show?"
"Yes."
"Do you think she could see the attraction?"
"I have no idea."
"Were you acting strangely after the affair?"
"Maybe. I don't know."
"Don't you think your wife knew that something was wrong?"
"I don't know,"
Keith retorted again. He lost control for only a moment, but his outburst was like the ding in a windshield that begins to grow into a crack. Adam knew it too. He was wearing Keith down with his questions.
"Let's talk about Jeremiah. You told Shelby on Friday that you saw Jeremiah Sloan on your property several times this year. He would come up to the house and the barn."
"That's true."
"Why did he do that?"
"I have no idea."
"But you knew the boy?"
"Of course."
"Did you talk to him?"
"Sometimes."
"What did you talk about?"
"Nothing of consequence. He said he was out exploring. I didn't think anything of it."
"Did he mention anything about the Ursulina?"
"The Ursulina?"
Keith shot me a puzzled look.
"No."
"Did he say anything about being near your house on the night your wife was killed?"
Keith's eyes widened with concern.
"No."
"And yet Shelby says you were afraid you would become a suspect in Jeremiah's disappearance."
"Yes, I did say that."
"Why would you be afraid of that if you did nothing wrong?"
"Well, here we are, Adam. Does that answer your question?"
"We're getting a warrant to search your property. What are we going to find when we do that?"
"Nothing."
"Are we going to find Jeremiah?"
"No, that's crazy."
"If the boy's here, it would be better to tell us now."
"I don't know what happened to Jeremiah. I had nothing to do with his disappearance. You can look all you want."
Adam stared down at a folder in his lap.
"I reviewed the notes from when we talked after Colleen's murder last fall. Do you still take psychotropic medications in conjunction with PTSD from your military service?"
"Yes."
"Did you take any of those medications on the day your wife was killed?"
"I'm sure I did. I take them every day. I told you that."
"Do you still suffer from night terrors?"
"Yes."
"The leg you lost. Does it hurt? Your back? Your neck?"
"Yes."
"In fact, you're in almost constant pain, aren't you?"
"Yes."
Does that take an emotional toll on you too?
Yes.
I felt as if I were watching the drip, drip, drip of a water torture. Keith was calm, but each question chipped away at his psyche, which wasn't all that strong to begin with. He needed this interview to end. I could see him glance at me in frustration as if I could rescue him from this, but I couldn't. This would only end with him telling us what he'd done. When I looked into his eyes, I knew he was hiding things. That was the problem I'd had from the beginning. I knew him too well. Adam shook his head in sympathy. He was Keith's friend now. He scooted his chair closer and leaned forward.
Look, Keith, I know the burden you're carrying. You went through hell overseas, physically and emotionally. I get it. I respect it. Like you say, you're in pain every day. All kinds of pain, the kind that the rest of us can't appreciate. Colleen couldn't appreciate it, could she? She didn't understand. She wanted to, but she didn't. And you wanted to be the husband she needed, but you couldn't do that either, could you?
Keith didn't take his eyes off me. Adam was talking, but Keith was looking at me, like he needed me to offer him some kind of absolution. I found it hard to stare back at him, but I did. I knew I was the one who could break him, and I had no choice. I mouthed, "Tell them." Then again, "Tell them." And he did.
Okay,
Keith murmured, opening up the floodgate. The water came crashing through.
You're right. I couldn't be the husband that Colleen needed. I never could. She was never happy.
Because of you?
Yes.
You had a bad marriage, and it was your fault.
Yes, it was.
You blamed yourself for putting your wife through hell, and then you went and cheated on her.
Keith blinked over and over.
Yes, I did.
That made you feel guilty?
Of course.
Did you lose sleep over it? Did you lay awake thinking about it?
Yes.
It was like a constant weight in your gut, making you sick.
Yes, it was.
So what did you do?
Keith said nothing. His breathing came faster and faster.
Did you tell her?
Adam asked. I saw sweat on Keith's face. He still said nothing, but his emotions began to come apart.
I think you told her, Adam went on. Come on, Keith. November 14th. You told Colleen what you did. You told her about the affair. You couldn't stand the burden anymore. You couldn't keep the secret, so you told her. Right?
Keith inhaled and held his breath. The seconds ticked by, and he didn't breathe. Then he finally spoke.
Yes, I told her.
I looked away in disgust. With him? With myself? Of course he'd told her. Of course he'd lied about it to me. He'd lied about everything.
You admit you told her about the affair,
Adam said coldly.
Yes.
Was it that day? November 14th?
Yes.
The two of you argued?
Yes.
She was hurt?
Adam asked.
Devastated?
Keith nodded.
Yes, she was.
So she went to Stanton. You were apart all day.
That's right.
And when she came home, you kept arguing, and you lost control, and you shot your wife.
No, I didn't do that.
You took the gun, your gun, and you killed her.
No.
Did you see Jeremiah?
Adam asked.
Did you know he was watching?
I didn't see him because I wasn't there.
When did you find out that he knew what you'd done?
I never found out anything like that. That's not the way it happened.
Keith, you've told us the truth about everything else. Why lie to us now?
I didn't kill Colleen.
Keith's voice rose as he denied it again. I couldn't resist staring at him. I had to see his face.
Look, I know you don't believe me. Yes, I had a bad marriage. It was my fault. I cheated on my wife. She was going to leave me and divorce me. All of that's true. But I didn't kill her. It wasn't me. I came home from the lake and found her dead.
Adam shook his head, as if Keith were a child making up a lie.
A burglar shot her? Really? You're sticking with that?
It's the truth, he told us.
and his eyes begged me to believe him. But I didn't. I didn't believe him. All those months later, I finally accepted what had been in front of me from the beginning. I'd slept with a man who killed his wife. Chapter 25. The next day, we searched under a sky blanketed with clouds. We searched for Jeremiah. The FBI canvassed Keith's house, barn, and land. Dozens of agents hunted for DNA, blood, hair, fiber, and fingerprints that would tell us whether Jeremiah had been there. They looked for freshly turned earth and the ash of recent fires that could be sifted for bones. Dogs traveled the land with their noses to the ground, sniffing for the smell of a body buried underground. Keith limped back and forth throughout the search, wearing a path in the damp grass. Every now and then he looked at me, and I looked back at him. Whatever feelings we'd had for each other were gone. We'd cordoned off the road to Keith's house. Beyond the police tape, dozens of people spied on the search. There had been no official announcement, but news of what was going on spread faster than a virus here. The whole town had gotten the word that Keith Whalen was a person of interest in the murder of Colleen Whalen and in the disappearance of Jeremiah Sloan. Ellen and Dennis were among the crowd outside, holding a vigil for their son. I was still an outcast. I wondered if I'd still have my job soon. My father could only protect me so far. At first, I stayed near the barricade on the dirt road to keep the search area secure, but it was obvious that rumors had spread about me, too, and I heard an undercurrent of nasty gossip with my name on it. Ellen Sloan's stare was icy, as if the loss of her son was my fault. I was upset to think she might not be entirely wrong. If I'd said something earlier, if I'd admitted the affair when we first began investigating Colleen's murder, then maybe things would have turned out differently. Eventually, I asked one of the other deputies to take my place, and I simply waited on the high fringe of Keith's property to watch the evidence being gathered. The morning passed slowly, and so did half the afternoon. A spitting drizzle made the day miserable. My hair, my face, my uniform were all wet. Still, the FBI swept the land and carried out bags of material to be analyzed in their lab. I wasn't sure if I was more concerned that they would find something, or that they would find nothing at all. Late in the day, my father came and found me on the hill. We hadn't talked since my revelations the day before. I felt sick to my stomach about what he would say. He stood next to me as we observed the search going on below us, and I waited out his silence with desperate impatience. "Am I fired?" I asked, when I couldn't take the tension anymore. Dad tugged at his mustache.
"What do you think? Should I fire you?"
"I don't know."
"Do you want to be fired?"
"No."
"Well, take it easy. You're not fired. I'll have to reprimand you. A formal letter will go in your file. And I think a suspension of some kind is in order. You made a very serious mistake, Shelby. You concealed important information about a suspect in a murder investigation."
"I know."
"I expect better from you."
"Yes, sir."
"More to the point, you should expect better from yourself."
I didn't reply. I didn't have to. He knew I felt the sting of his words, and he wasn't done with me.
"I'm not going to be sheriff forever, Shelby. We both know that. The next election is in November, and Violet has already suggested that I should step down gracefully. That's what I'm inclined to do. You know I was hoping to be here long enough that you could run to succeed me, but obviously you're not ready for that."
The truth hurt. "Obviously," I whispered.
"I love you, Shelby. I'm sorry."
"I love you too, Dad. Don't be sorry. This was my screw-up." My father walked away down the sloping grass. I watched him go, and I knew I would always remember how he looked at that moment, still in control of his world for a little while. After he left, I couldn't stay there. I had to go. I turned around and hiked through the long grass until I couldn't see Keith's house or barn anymore. His land went on for many more acres, but the woods took over. I saw a rough trail matted down in the underbrush, and I followed it. I knew where I was. I could keep going for less than a mile and arrive where the Sloanes lived. This was the route Jeremiah would have taken, flashlight in hand, on November 14th. I'd always thought of him as a shy follower. Not a brave kid, but there he was, alone at night, out looking for the Ursulina. Just like I'd done at the same age. I'd been on this trail many times myself over the years. Sometimes I'd come here alone, sometimes with Rose, sometimes with Trina and the rest of the Stryker girls. I recognized old-growth trees that had been here my whole life. I saw glacial rocks where I used to sit and listen to the birds. If you dug down under the moss, you'd find places where I'd scratched my initials. Another quarter mile took me to the place we called Black Lake. It was the haunted lake in the valley with the trees sprouting from the water, where we would dare each other to swim after we told scary stories about what was lurking below. The wind scraped low branches across the lake's surface and caused ripples. By the shore, I saw a high boulder we used to climb to jump into the water. I could still hear the echo of our squeals and screams. I climbed the boulder again like I used to do when I was a kid. It was high enough to think you were queen of the world up there. You could see the whole lake, edge to edge, and it was really just a large pond, barely 100 yards across. Part of me thought about taking off my clothes and jumping in the way I had years ago. But I didn't. Below me, I saw a clearing where we would lie after swimming. You couldn't really call it a beach because there was no sand, just a few feet of low weeds where we would spread out our towels. When I looked closely, I saw something in the clearing. What I saw made me jump down the sheer side of the boulder near the water, almost twisting my ankle in the process. I fought through an overgrown patch of snake root and broke into the open. And there they were. Stones. Towers of stones. At least 2 dozen of them, made of the kind of flat gray rocks I'd seen in a plastic bucket in Jeremiah's bedroom. Some of the towers were only a few inches high. Others had tumbled over and lay in piles. Others had somehow survived the wind and rain to stay standing a foot or more above the weeds. I knew what these were. These were cairns, built for the dead. I had no doubt that Jeremiah had built them. He'd seen a woman killed on this land, and this was his way of making peace with it. But it wasn't just the stones themselves that caught my eye. Something sparkled in the brush near one of the cairns, as if it had been placed atop the tower and fallen down. It was shiny even under the dark sky and the thick cover of trees. I knelt and stared at it. It was a ring made of yellow gold with a single, large, square-cut diamond mounted in the center. A wedding ring. I put on a plastic glove from my pocket and picked up the ring to examine it. There was no inscription. Nothing to identify its former owner. Even so, I knew whose finger it had been taken from. Hurriedly, in the dark, while her dead body was still warm. When I looked at the still surface of the lake, I also knew what we would find when we searched under the water. The stories of Black Lake hiding something horrible were true. Colleen Whalen's jewelry had never been stolen by a burglar. It had been here the whole time. You see, Keith made a mistake. Panicked people covering up crimes often do. He'd put all of his wife's jewelry in a plastic bag that night. His expensive dress watch, too. Maybe if he'd disposed of the pieces separately, we wouldn't have found them. But when the FBI dragged the silty, muddy lake bed, they located the plastic bag, filled with water under its loose knot. Everything Keith had removed from their bedroom was still inside. I imagined him frantically gathering up things that night to make us believe that a thief had killed Colleen. But would a thief leave her diamond ring behind? No. So he ripped it off her finger as he was heading for the woods and must have shoved it carelessly in his pocket. Somewhere on his way to the lake in the darkness, he'd lost the ring. And sometime after that, Jeremiah had found it. But Colleen's jewelry wasn't the only thing that Keith had hidden to get away with murder and hide his guilt. He'd put the gun in the bag, too. The gun that killed her. With that discovery, we finally had everything we needed to solve Colleen's murder. Dad arrested Keith Whalen and took him away. Soon enough, he would be headed to trial, and then headed to prison. I was pretty sure that he would never be coming home. Chapter 26. Looking back, I think of the search for Jeremiah in two phases, the beginning and the end. I say that with the perspective of time because, like I told you, all of this happened more than 10 years ago. I'm no longer the young 25-year-old I was then. I didn't know it at the time, but with the arrest of Keith Whalen, the beginning was about to be over. There was never really a middle in this case, just years of nothingness. And the end, well, the end was still a long way into the future. 6 weeks after Jeremiah disappeared, school began again without him. Summer was over. Life was moving on for everyone in town. The FBI had left town 3 weeks earlier with the case still formally unsolved. There were no more volunteers filling up the motels. The media had long since let the mystery fall out of the headlines. News feeds the beast, and when there's no news to report, the beast moves on to new territory. It's not like we were going to forget Jeremiah, but there comes a point in every investigation where there are simply no more clues, and no matter how hard you try, you can't create them. You can keep the file open. You can pull it out every few months and read it again and try to think of things you've missed. And then you realize that all you can do is put the file back and wait. Wait for something to happen. Wait for a break in the case that might never come. I could see all that ahead of us as I sat in the Nowhere Cafe that September night with Dad, Monica, and Adam. We were finally getting back to our old routines. I was texting Jeannie Samper about my next volunteer shift at the Raptor Center. Monica was reading spicy excerpts of a romance novel to Moody in his urn. Adam was flipping through the pages of a motorcycle magazine. Dad had his newspaper open to the crossword puzzle.
"A destination for the well-meaning traveler," he announced to the three of us as he twirled a sharpened pencil in his hand. "Four letters. Anyone? Any ideas?"
I was the only one paying attention. "Do you have any of the letters, Dad?"
"I don't."
I thought hard about the clue, but that's the worst way to solve a puzzle. You can't force it. You have to let it come to you. Sooner or later, at the strangest times, the answers would pop into my head, long after they didn't matter anymore. A destination for the well-meaning traveler. I had nothing. Dad waited until it was obvious that I couldn't help him, and then he buried himself in the other clues of the crossword again. He looked oddly free. Ever since he'd decided not to run for re-election, a burden had been lifted from him. He no longer had anything to prove. It had been good for his mind, too, without the stress. He was a little sharper. He'd had fewer incidents. All that was good. But I was under no illusions about where this was going, and neither was he. I saw Breezy behind the counter wielding a knife on a cherry pie. She wandered over to our booth with a slice of pie a la mode for Adam. He hadn't ordered it, but she knew what he liked. She wore a big red button on her jean shirt that read, "Sheriff Twilly." Adam had been passing them out for weeks.
"On the house," she told him with a wink.
"Or is that too much like a bribe now that you're going to be a big shot and all?"
A satisfied grin crept across Adam's face as he cut into the pie with his spoon.
"We'll just call it a campaign contribution."
Yes, Adam was going to be my new boss. I'd made my peace with that. Only days after my father announced he was stepping down, Adam had let me know that he was running to replace him. His mother was happy to see him doing something important with his life. Most of us thought he was still too young, but he had the advantage of being the only candidate interested in the position. He'd also courted Violet Rocha, and Violet had persuaded the county board to endorse him. So we all knew the job was his. Being young wasn't necessarily a problem. Dad had been young when he got the job, too. I had a hard time wrapping my head around the idea of Sheriff Twilley, but I hoped he'd grow into it. I had to admit he'd changed over the course of the summer. I hadn't seen him with a drink since he'd launched his campaign. He'd dialed back the sexual innuendos and flirting with every girl he met, including me. He'd even asked my opinion on a case a couple of times. All in all, this was a new Adam. I guess sometimes the position makes the man. Was I disappointed that Adam's decision meant I wouldn't be sheriff of Middle County myself? Not really. I'd never been ambitious in that way. Dad had been hoping to hand the keys to me, but I didn't care. Anyway, I had his health to think about. I had Trina and Anna to think about, too, because Trina wasn't doing well. My life was going to be busy enough. So, you see, we were all moving on. I listened to the murmur of talk in the diner that night, and I realized I hadn't heard Jeremiah's name once. Not once. That was a first. The talk was about the new school year, the end of the state fair, the end of summer, the grouse hunting season, the announcement that Rose was putting the Rest in Peace up for sale, and the lineup of country concerts at the Indian Casino near Stanton. But not Jeremiah. Most locals thought they already knew what had happened to Jeremiah. To the police and the FBI, the case was still open, but not to the people here. They blamed Keith Whalen. He was guilty. If you murdered your wife, it wasn't a big leap to imagine killing a child to cover it up. You could have surveyed anyone in the diner that night, and they would have told you that Keith had discovered that Jeremiah saw him shoot Colleen. Maybe the boy had confessed it one of the times he'd wandered up to Keith's house. Or maybe Keith had seen the boy and his cairns near Black Lake and asked him why he was building those little towers of stone on his land. However it happened, Keith found out. So he kidnapped Jeremiah and killed him and hid his body in one of those remote places in the North Woods that no one would ever find. Maybe Anna's dream was right, and he'd carved a cross on a birch tree near the grave, too. Jeremiah wasn't coming back. The man who'd killed him was already in jail. The people of everywhere were ready to put this tragedy behind them and start living their lives again. But first, Jeremiah had to be avenged. First, the past had to be erased. As the four of us sat in the booth at the Nowhere, Monica's phone rang. Her emergency phone. She answered it. Her face fell. And she looked at us with an expression that said we should all have been expecting this.
Fire, she said.
The flames had already consumed most of Keith's house by the time we got there. Even from 100 yards away, I felt the ferocious heat on my face. Gray smoke billowed against the black sky, and we had to cover our mouths and noses to keep the poison out of our lungs. Ash fell around us and floated like snow in the air. Night turned to day. The crackle of burning wood sounded like the growl of the Ursulina. As I watched, the roof of the house caved inward, and the walls bent and collapsed in mountainous showers of sparks. On the other side of the shallow hill, I saw a second plume of smoke, where the barn burned, devouring my memories. There was nothing to be done. None of it could be saved. The firefighters used their water on the surrounding grass and trees to keep the flames from spreading to the forest. Fortunately, the wind barely moved that night, and after a while, a light drizzle began to fall, sizzling into steam as it tamped down the flames. 6 teenagers sat in handcuffs in the back of 2 of our cruisers. They were all boys from the high school. Adrian Sloan was among them. We'd caught the kids as they were scrambling to escape the scene. They'd stayed too long to watch their handiwork. I knew they'd be punished, but I didn't think a judge would be too harsh with minors, not when one of them had lost a brother. They'd probably get community service. After a while, their records would be cleared, and we'd all get on with the business of forgetting that Keith Whalen had ever lived in everywhere.
I stood there for hours that night, hypnotized by the fire. Even after it was out, I stayed. We had to make sure it didn't catch again, and I was one of the volunteers who spent the entire night watching over the hot, soggy funeral pyre. When it was safe enough to get close, I walked the perimeter with my flashlight to see if anything had escaped. Any little piece of Keith and Colleen. I did the same at the barn. But the fire had been thorough and consumed everything except a few scorched beams and shards of melted glass. Was this justice? All I can tell you is what I believed that night. I believed that Keith lied to me. I believed he murdered his wife and covered it up, and I believed that 12 good men and women would pronounce him guilty. Was it an accident? Was it a crime of passion that got out of control? Was it a burst of rage that bubbled up out of the horrors of his past? Possibly. That was up to the judge and jury, and they could decide how long he would spend behind bars. Either way, he would pay for his crime. But Jeremiah? Call me naive if you want, but I wasn't convinced that Keith Whalen had really taken that boy. If he had, we would have found Jeremiah's body hidden under the water of Black Lake, like the evidence of Colleen's murder. But we didn't find him there. No. We hadn't solved the mystery yet. We didn't know the truth about Jeremiah. Back then, I wasn't sure we would ever know what really happened. I remember wandering alone beside the remnants of the fire that night. You could say it's burned into my memory. As I picked my way beside the ruins, I said one word aloud to myself. Just one word. Otherwise, I was quiet, feeling awed by the devastation. Hell, I murmured, staring at the scene. There was plenty in that twisted panorama of destruction to remind me of hell, but actually I was thinking about Dad's crossword puzzle. Like I told you, the answers usually come at the strangest moments, long after you've given up. Hell. The destination for a well-meaning traveler was hell. That was where the road of good intentions usually led us. Part 2. The Well-Meaning Traveler. Chapter 27. Anna and I glided on cross-country skis through the fresh bed of snow filling the cemetery trails. She took the lead up and down the hills, and I followed. With each breath, we exhaled clouds of steam. The skeletal branches of the trees cradled the snow and shook wet, cold blasts into our faces as the wind blew. My cheeks felt numb. It was January 22nd, a bitter and blustery Monday morning, during one of those days-long stretches of winter gray where you wonder if the sun still exists. Ahead of me, Anna brought herself to a stop halfway down the shallow slope. She leaned on one of her ski poles and stared into the thick of the forest. I pulled up beside her. Among the shaggy pines and flaky white trunks of the young birches stood the massive, gnarled body of the famous Middle County beech tree we called Bartholomew. The tree had survived storms and fires for more than 200 years. Its roots dug into the ground like fingers, and its many fat arms made it look like a troll that had been turned to stone. If you grew up in everywhere, you'd almost certainly paid a visit to Bartholomew on a sixth-grade science outing. Two of Bartholomew's finger roots had grown apart over the decades to create a deep hollow like a cave. I'd written a song once about Barty's Hollow, one of the songs I played for kids on my guitar during Sunday story time at the library. The chorus went like this. It's big enough to build a house, but don't you go inside, 'cause wolverines and sleeping bears use the cave to hide.
Think there's a bear inside?
Anna asked me. She remembered the song too. Could be, I replied. In fact, the hollow made a perfect den, so I wouldn't have been at all surprised to find a black bear spending the winter there.
Maybe we should check it out, she said. There could be cubs by now.
Or we could just let sleeping bears lie. Anna shrugged. She unhooked a plastic bottle from her belt and squirted cold water into her mouth. We'd been outside for 20 minutes and the bottle was already partially frozen. I watched her eyes go from Bartholomew to the other trees around him, searching one by one among the birches. She did that wherever we were in the woods. I don't think she realized that I noticed it, but I knew what she was looking for. A cross. After all this time, she was still hoping to find Jeremiah. Anna peeled a red balaclava from her head, letting her blonde hair cascade below her shoulders. Her creamy skin had a pink flush from the cold. At 20 years old, she was now a beautiful young woman. She'd grown up tall and lean, with curves to make the rest of us jealous. She had dark eyebrows above pale blue eyes and a face that looked stolen from a painting. When she smiled, she was the spitting image of her mother, and I felt like Trina was still with me. But Anna hardly ever smiled. We weren't even a quarter mile from our destination, but Anna made no effort to push off on her skis. It was like this whenever we came here. When we could see the cemetery grove ahead of us at the base of the hill, she would stop and procrastinate, hoping I would change my mind. "It's not much farther," I said, although we both knew that. Anna refused to even look down the hill. She unzipped one of the pockets on her ski jacket and extracted a pack of cigarettes. She lit one and inhaled, and then she held it between two fingers and extended it in my direction, offering me a puff. I shook my head, saying nothing. She knew I didn't smoke. She knew I hated the fact that she did. We played this same game all the time.
"Barty's sick," Anna said, nodding at the tree.
"Oh?"
"Yeah. I met a guy at a bar in Stanton last week. He's a forestry major at the college. He says it's some kind of bark fungus. He showed me photos at his place. Barty might not make it more than 2 or 3 more years. Sucks, huh?"
I didn't like to think of Bartholomew toppling over and taking a couple of centuries of Middle County history with him. Of course, I knew the point of the story wasn't to tell me about Barty's fungus. It was to let me know that she'd been in a bar the previous weekend, met a stranger, and slept with him. "We should go," I said, not taking the bait. Anna fluffed her blonde hair with both hands.
"I don't know why we have to do this all the time."
"We don't do it all the time. We do it on Mother's Day and on January 22nd.
"Well, Mother's Day is only 4 months away. Let's wait."
"Come on, Anna."
"I'm cold,"
she complained.
"It's freezing out here. It's stupid to go at this time of year. I told you I didn't want to come."
"This won't take long. Then we can head home." Anna shook her head, and her jaw hardened with stubborn resistance.
"I'm not doing it this time, Shelby. I'm sick of this. You can go by yourself if it means so much to you. Tell her I said hi."
I pulled off my own balaclava, and the wind slapped my face as if it were mad at me. "Look, go home if you want, but it's been 10 years, Anna. 10 years.
"Do you think I don't know that?"
she snapped. "I know you do. I think that's why you don't want to go. I'm just saying you'll regret it if you miss this one." Anna tilted her head and blew smoke toward the trees.
"Blah, blah, blah. God, Shelby, give it a rest, will you? I know you're into the spiritual New Age stuff, but I'm just not, okay? Coming out here doesn't change a thing. If it makes you feel better, great, go for it. But I hate it."
"Okay. If that's how you feel, then go." Anna threw her cigarette into the snow. Awkwardly, she lifted up her skis and turned around on the trail, forcing me to glide a few steps forward to make room for her. I twisted around to watch her over my shoulder. She settled into the tracks we'd made, and with a giant shove on both ski poles, she launched herself toward the crest of the hill, heading back the way we'd come. Her arms and legs pumped. Her loose hair flew behind her. A few seconds later, she slid across the top and vanished. It was just me and Bartholomew now. I wondered if he really was sick. I tapped my poles on the slope and let gravity whisk me downhill past the dense trees. A couple of minutes later, I reached the clearing where I slowed to a stop. It had been a mild winter until recently, melting most of the early season snow, but January had taken us back to the deep freeze. 6 inches of fresh snow had covered up some of the flat headstones that we usually saw here. It was like missing old friends. Even so, I relished the peace and silence. The grove, like the bears, was in hibernation until spring, although a few deer tracks tiptoed through the fresh powder to let me know I wasn't alone. Trina was buried on the far side of the clearing. Her headstone was built of pink marble and topped with the sculpture of an angel. With her rosy face and wings, she looked like a fairy caught in the middle of a dance. I skied that way until the angel was in front of me, and Trina was below me in the frozen ground. Her carved name rose over the snow.
So, I'm back.
I never felt strange talking to her as if she could hear me. Anna didn't feel the same way. In all the years we'd been making these visits, Anna had never said a single word to her mother. She'd always stood beside me in frozen silence, her face showing the anger she felt that Trina had left her so young. But until this time, she'd always come with me. This was the first year she'd made good on her threat to turn back and leave me to visit the grave alone. "My father says hi," I went on. Then I figured, why lie to the dead? "Actually, that's not true. I told him I was coming here, but he didn't remember you." "Don't feel bad. Most days he still knows me and Monica, but not too many others. He doesn't even recognize Adam anymore. He's still physically healthy, which is a good thing, I guess. I don't know, maybe he's happy, too. I'm the one who can't handle it. It's getting to a point where I don't know how much longer I can do it myself, you know? I still have to work. Friends help out, but there's only so much they can do. I'm putting off the decision because I don't want to deal with it. I can't even think about it." I wiped a couple of tears from my face. I thought about what else to tell her. I always gave her an update about her husband. "Carl changed jobs. He can work remotely now, so he doesn't have to travel as much. That's good. And he's seeing somebody. A woman he met at an IT class he was giving in Stanton. It's been a year now. It seems serious. I didn't tell you last time because I wasn't sure it was going anywhere, but now, I don't know. He might be ready to move on. He didn't know what you'd think about that, but I told him you'd say it was crazy he waited so long." The wind blew and swirled a little cloud of snow around the angel's face. I thought that was Trina agreeing with me. "And Anna," I began, but I didn't know what to say. "I'm sorry she's not here. It's still hard for her. She's so lost, Trina. It breaks my heart." I crouched down in the snow, so I was eye to eye with the angel. "She hates the woman Carl is seeing, but it's not about her. I've met this woman. She's nice. Anna just can't accept it. She had a huge fight with Carl over the summer, and she left. Took all her stuff and moved out. We didn't know where she was. We were all in a panic. Breezy finally told me she saw her in the bar in Witchtree with Will Gruder. That girl knows how to pick them, doesn't she? I mean, Will hasn't been much trouble since his brother died, but I wasn't going to let her stay there. I told her she had two choices, move back home or move in with me. So she picked me. She's been living with me and Dad for about 3 months. At least she has a mission in life now. She wants to find every way humanly possible to push my buttons and make me lose it with her. So far I haven't, but the ice is getting pretty thin." I didn't tell her the rest. I didn't tell her about Anna barely graduating from high school and saying no to college. I didn't tell her about the girl getting fired from 4 jobs in 18 months since then. Or about the boys and the bars, one after another. Or about the shoplifting charge in Stanton that I was able to get dropped when I paid the owner back. Then again, I suppose she knows. "Anyway, I miss you. I can't believe it's been 10 years. Every time I pass your photograph on my dresser, I stop and think it's just not possible that you're gone. I don't know. Life just feels pretty empty at the moment. The thing is, I'm letting you down. That's what really hurts. I promised you I'd be there for Anna, and I can't reach her. I don't know how to get through to her. She's such a great kid, but she's in so much pain, and she shuts me out. She's going off the rails, just like you feared, and I can't do anything about it. I could use your help, Trina. That sounds silly, but wow, I could really use your help right now." She didn't answer, of course. I laughed a little at myself. There was nothing more to say, so I told Trina goodbye and said I'd be back on Mother's Day. Then I worked myself around on my skis to head home. That's when I saw the owl. He was perched on top of a stone cross on one of the headstones jutting out of the snow. A perfect, serious, white and gray snowy owl. We stared at each other like old friends. I hadn't seen one in a long, long time. In fact, it took me a while to remember the last time I'd seen a snowy owl, and I realized it was atop Adam's motorcycle on the day Jeremiah disappeared. Was it another sign? Did Trina send it to me? You don't have to believe that if you don't want to. All I know is, later that same day, Jeremiah's ghost came back into my life. And just like 10 years ago, everything changed. Chapter 28. Winter is traditionally the slow time at the Nowhere Cafe. Not too many tourists come to Middle County in January. A few ice fishermen, a few lonely artists, a few naturalists doing research. Otherwise, we have no one to talk to except each other, and we always look up when the bell rings on the diner door to see who's coming in next. It's slow for the sheriff's department, too. We get busy during ice storms when cars and trucks slide off the highway, but sub-zero cold tends to keep people inside and out of trouble. The nights bring out the domestic disturbance calls, but the days can pass without the phone ringing at all. On that Monday afternoon, Monica and I sat in a booth with my father. He was working intently on one of his puzzles, although he no longer tried to solve the actual clues. About a year ago, he'd started filling the boxes with random words. At least he was still using real words when he did. One of the next warning signs, according to the doctors, would be when he began using nonsense ones.
"Looks like you're almost done with that one, Tom,"
Breezy said brightly as she topped up our coffee. She was right. Dad had filled in most of the boxes, and he beamed when she noticed it.
"Why, thank you, young lady. If I am good at one thing in this world, it's crossword puzzles."
Breezy squeezed his shoulder affectionately. She'd been young lady to Dad for about 9 months. That was what he called all of the women he didn't recognize now. Age didn't matter in his calculations. I was still Shelby. Monica was still Monica. Everyone else in the world was young lady or sir. He didn't know who any of them were. The doctors in Stanton had told me that my father was in what they called stage 5 of the disease. We'd been at that plateau for about 2 years. If you asked him what he'd had for breakfast, he wouldn't have a clue, but he could talk about the details of police cases from decades earlier, as if they'd happened the previous day. Maybe in his mind they had. He could still bathe and dress himself, and he made it a point to look good the way he always had. But I wasn't comfortable with him being alone anymore, and the doctors said it was only a matter of time before he moved on to stage 6, at which point I would either have to quit my job to take care of him 24/7 or find a facility we could afford. I hated the idea of both options. Dad put down his pencil. He focused on Monica, who was crocheting a navy blue scarf that I knew she intended as a present for him.
"How's that puppy of yours?"
he asked her.
"Is he housebroken yet? You have to stick with training once you start and be consistent, you know. Firm and consistent. Dogs appreciate that."
Sometimes we couldn't always keep up with the shifting sands of my father's mind.
"Puppy?"
Monica asked, looking puzzled.
"Moody. Isn't that what you call him? Malamutes are such beautiful dogs."
Moody, of course, was sitting where he always did, in the flowered urn on the table in front of Monica.
"Oh, he's just fine, Tom. Thank you for asking. Of course, puppies have limitless energy. I swear that dog will wear me out."
"I've thought about getting a dog myself," Dad went on. "Shelby loves the idea. It's good for kids to grow up with a dog. But right now, that little girl is so much work that I don't think I could handle a puppy, too."
I wondered how old I was at that moment in his mind. 2? 3? Dad had a proud, happy look on his face, but then he glanced across the table and focused on me, and there I was, 35 years old. He knew me. He recognized me, but his eyes went glassy with confusion as his mind tried to reconcile the impossible contradictions. I couldn't be a toddler who wanted a dog and an adult in my deputy's uniform at the same time. The confusion made him afraid, and I hated seeing fear on my father's face. Then, as if giving up on things that made no sense to him, he went back to finishing his puzzle. I got out of the booth because I couldn't stay there at that moment. Monica patted my arm in sympathy. I followed Breezy back to the lunch counter and sat down in one of the chairs. I'd left my coffee on the table, so Breezy filled another cup for me.
Sorry, Shell. That's hard.
Thanks.
Where's Anna? I mean, it's the anniversary, right? I figured the two of you would be hanging out together.
I truly have no idea where she is.
Things aren't so good with you two?
Not good at all. Breezy lowered her voice.
Listen, just so you know, I saw Anna back at the bar in Witch Tree last weekend. She was with Will Gruder again.
Great, that's just great. Was she drinking?
Beer.
I shook my head. She's underage. I could bust the place.
I know, but don't do that. I'll talk to the owner and try to get her cut off if she comes in again.
Is she doing drugs, too?
Not that I saw.
Come on, Breezy, be straight with me.
I am, Shell. I haven't seen her with drugs. As far as I know, she's clean.
Thanks. I eyed Breezy, who was as thin as a sapling but had clear, bright eyes. How about you? Are you still clean? She offered a cynical laugh and pulled up her sleeves to show off her bare arms.
Cleanest I've ever been. Being on food stamps will do that to you. No drugs, no cigarettes, and hey, I've lost 10 pounds. This no-money diet really does the trick.
You need any help?
I need plenty of help, but you're not rolling in dough either. I'll be fine. Something will turn up.
Everyone around here knew Breezy had it rough this year. She'd never been flush, but she'd had an emergency appendectomy the previous summer, and the medical bills had cleaned her out. The diner didn't need her for extra shifts during the slow season, and there weren't a lot of ways to make money on the side in January. Breezy leaned across the counter. She tried to put the best spin she could on my situation with Anna.
I know you don't want to hear this, but it's actually sweet that she hangs out with Will. Most girls won't do that. I mean, the burns and all.
It's Will Gruder, Breezy.
I get it. He's not your favorite person.